Or if it's gonna... Yeah, it looks like it is. Okay, when the light comes on when we're recording. Okay, when and why did you come to Alaska?
Well, I first came when I was in the Air Force. I was in the Air Force Intelligence Service, and we had 7 or 8 little detachments, information gathering detachments scattered around the world. At that time, there were 2 or 3 in Alaska, and I was stationed out on St. Lawrence Island for a while. That was in 1954 when I was out on St. Lawrence Island. It was during the height of the Cold War, and a couple of incidents happened out there that were kind of interesting, had to do with the Cold War. While I was there, we were a tenant organization at an AC&W site, and one morning, very early in the morning, an Eskimo hunter came up in his umiak near the station and reported that there was a submarine surface just offshore, about a mile offshore. And so the AC&W station all went on alert, of course, and they radioed and the information, and two fighter planes came out from Fairbanks, flew out to Nome and then across to the island, and found the submarine just offshore from the Air Force AC&W site, and buzzed it a number of times, but the submarine just sat there, didn't react at all. Finally, the planes had to go back for refueling, and 2 more came out, and about that time, the submarine just submerged and went away. It was just one of the little harassment things that the Soviets were famous for in those days. Then the day after I left the island, after I'd been there about 2 months, 2.5 months, the Soviets shot down an American Navy patrol plane off the west end of the island, and the plane had been flying just offshore, well within the, well on this side of the American side of the international dateline, which was the airspace division between the Soviet Union and the United States. They shot him down anyway, but they managed to fly the plane over to the island and crashed it on the beach. Some hunters, walrus hunters out there, Eskimos, saw the plane go down, and they went down the coast and rescued the men, and nobody was killed, but there were a couple of them injured. That was that one very nearly created an international incident, and like I say, this was during the height of the Cold War anyway.
But they pretty much got away with that?
Well, yeah, like a lot of other things.
That's amazing, I never knew that. So what was your first job at St. Lawrence Island? What was...
Well, I was, like I say, I was in the Air Force Intelligence Service, and I was working with some specialized electronic equipment. That's what I did when I was in Alaska, that during my first visit, first time I came here. I also served out at King Salmon for a while, several months during that tour of duty, and at Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage.
And then you left and you came back?
Yes, I left for a few months stateside, and then came back as a civilian. And after a couple of odd jobs in Anchorage, I got on with the ITT, Federal Electric Corporation, when they had the first maintenance and operation contract for the Air Force's White Alice system. It's a long-range communication system that was developed for the Air Force, primarily to handle all the communications for the military in Alaska, the Dew Line, Pine Tree Line, the AC&W network, all the different radio sites, different communications for Air Force, Army, Navy, Coast Guard. But the facilities were more than the Air Force or the military needed, and so they leased some facilities to civilian agencies as well. And by the time the White Olive system was completely built and manned, there was a network of some 45 or 47 manned stations plus some unmanned repeater sites scattered around Alaska, all interconnected. And for many years, the system handled all of the long lines communications for the military and almost all of them for civilian agencies as well, FAA and long distance telephone lines. And
so that's what opened up communication in Alaska?
Pretty much. Before that, before the White Olive system was developed and built, almost all communications within and to and from Alaska depended on the old ACS system, which is very, very subject to atmospheric conditions, weather, snow, rain, anything could deteriorate the quality of the communications, and sometimes villages or even military sites were out of communication with the rest of the world for days at a time. The White Olive system corrected all that. I worked first through the White Olive system in Anchorage in training, and then briefly at several stations, Aniak, King Salmon, Kodiak, and then my first regular assignment was at a place called Calicut Creek up in the interior, a very remote site on top of a mountain. No village, no road, no rivers, nothing. Not far from Galena, but the only way in and out was by small planes off a little strip there at the station.
Did you have regular flights in and out, or did they?
Not regular, no. About once a week or so, they would try to get planes in there, but that didn't always work either. But the biggest planes that they could handle at that strip was the old DC-3, which brought in most of our supplies. And it occasionally allowed for the people working there to get out to Anchorage or Fairbanks or go home on vacation or something.
Get out to civilization.
But not often. Then I went to Bethel for nearly 2 years, and then came to work at Pillar Mountain in Kodiak, where I spent the next, well, until I closed the station in the late 70s.
You said earlier that it was some Wallace hunters that found the men in the plane that were shot down. Do you guys have a lot of chance to interact with the natives in these areas? Or?
Not much on St. Lawrence Island, but I did get to meet a few of the Yupik Eskimos who lived there. They were one family, especially that I got to know pretty well, had a hunting camp over near the end of the island where we were stationed, and they would come out there and spend several months every year, and I got to know them. In those days, there were a lot of people out in that country who didn't speak any English at all, and that family didn't. There was a man and his wife, two little children, a boy and a girl, and the woman's mother, the old grandmother. They lived out there in this little shack up along the beach for several months of the year. They would hunt seals and walrus and do a lot of fishing, dry the fish. They kept a few dogs, but I never saw them used as a dog team, although they did when they went back to their town and their village at Savunga.
How did you talk? I guess you couldn't really talk to them if you didn't speak the language.
No, they invited me into their house the first time I met them. I was walking down the beach several miles from the station and was startled when I saw two little children coming toward me. And they came came up to me, a little boy and a little girl, and they wanted me to go with them to their cabin, and I could see the building down there, down the beach another mile or so. So I went there, and they invited me in. We smiled a lot at each other, but didn't have any language in common. They made tea. We sat on the floor or on little blocks of wood. There were no chairs or furniture that we're familiar with in the place. Their stove was a little flat thing that the top of it was about 8 inches off the floor, with a kettle on it that had hot water, and they broke pieces of tea off of brick tea. I'd never seen that before. And smashed it up in a little pot and poured hot water in it, made tea from that. But then we ate some of their dried fish.
One of the safer native fares.
And we smiled a lot. Got along great.
Couldn't talk back. What were some of the hardest things? I mean, you came from Midwest Iowa, farm country. What were some of the hardest things for you to adjust to coming to Alaska?
Oh, I didn't think any of it was hard in the way of adjustment. I just enjoyed it all. It was very interesting to me. Things were so different from what they were back in on the farm in the Midwest. But it was very interesting to me. I liked it. I enjoyed it all.
What were some of the differences? I mean, obviously you didn't have the communication that you did back in Iowa.
Right, and there were no roads in most of those areas. And even in Bethel, there were very few roads, very few cars. Everything was dependent on air service. And on the rivers, they use skiffs in summer and dog teams in winter in those days. Later on, of course, they all took to using snow machines and still do in winter. But in those days, it was all bush planes, skiffs, and dog teams for travel out in West Alaska and up on St. Lawrence Island in West and Northwest Alaska.
Did you get much chance to sample from some of the native foods, or did you have
a few times? Yes. Became familiar with seal and walrus, and even sampled muskox one time, and of course sheephish, which was a great favorite. A lot of different things that most people in the Midwest never even heard of, much less sampled.
Or really desired to.
Some of it, yeah. And agutuk, the famous...
Agutuk?
Yes, it's sometimes called Eskimo ice cream. It's made with, or in the traditional way, it was made with the caribou fat and seal oil. Mixed together by hand in a bowl until it was a real frothy, pure white substance. Looked a lot like Crisco. Tasted something like it too, but with a distinct seal flavor or something. And then at holidays it was considered a special treat, and they would put some berries that they'd picked in summer and stored in a seal poke full of seal oil to preserve them. They throw some of the berries in the agutuk to flavor it and color it. And I've had a lot of that, especially around Russian Christmas and New Year's time.
Not exactly Haagen-Dazs.
It was different from Haagen-Dazs, yes.
Okay, when you moved to Kodiak, what, about 1959 or 15?
Yes.
And that was just about the time that statehood was declared.
Yes, Alaska became a state. The documents were signed January 3rd, in 1959 by President Eisenhower. And about 6 months later, Hawaii became the 50th state that same year.
Can you tell me some of the reactions of people? I mean, not everybody was happy about it, obviously.
Well, that's true. Some people were not, but the voting had been pretty heavily in favor of statehood. I think a lot of people, at that time, there were quite a few people from stateside coming up to Alaska, and they didn't like non-representation. They wanted the voting franchise, and besides, they thought that, I think they thought that Alaska was too dependent on nothing but the military, which at that time was very strong in Alaska, and spent quite a lot of money here. A lot of the development that the territory and then later state enjoyed in those days came indirectly or directly from military money spent here. But a lot of people saw a lot more advantages to full statehood, and it passed heavily. There are still disadvantages, maybe. Some people say there are, but it became the 59th state. 49th state in 1959.
Okay. You were working up on Pillar Mountain, and you soon moved up to Pillar Mountain. And you were there during the Good Friday earthquake in 1964. You were...
Yes, at that time we had our home on the side of the mountain, on the slopes up above the KI Hotel. Up on the topmost layer, there were three homes up there, and we occupied one of them. And in 1964, on March 27th, which was a Good Friday, in the evening, the earthquake hit, and it hit very violently. But most of the homes and most of the buildings in Kodiak in those days were frame construction, and many of them sat on pilings driven into the ground. And there was not an awful lot of damage done by the earthquake itself, except to concrete and stone and brick structures, but there were very few of those. The sea walls that had been built in 1958, enclosing the downtown boat harbor, were badly damaged by the quake itself, torn apart, the rocks were scattered, and a lot of the big sections of both seawalls just disappeared underwater. And about 30 minutes later, after we'd got back inside our house after the earthquake, I glanced out the front windows, and I could see the northeast end of Woody Island, and suddenly saw huge waves, spray, crashing up on the edge of the island. Never seen anything like it before. And that was my first hint that there might be a tsunami coming. I called the other people that were nearby, and my wife and the neighbor lady was out in front of her house. And then we watched just moments later as the first tsunami came down the channel between your island and the town, and it circled into the what was left of the boat harbor, diverted by what was left of the seawalls, and it was so violent and so powerful that it ripped out all the floating docks, the piers, the pilings, the boats, everything. There wasn't a thing left. It pushed it all up into the town, into the whole downtown district, and the water went up about almost to the present police station location, carrying all this debris and boats and docks and what have you with it. And then after a few minutes of the general destruction of the whole downtown district, the water receded very fast again, and it carried most of the stuff out with it, including a lot of cars parked downtown and down near the boat harbor, and a lot of buildings, houses, business places, and most of the boats that it had hauled up into town, but it left the larger boats high and dry in the downtown district. One of them, one of the larger ones, was deposited up near where Dr. Guy's new building is located now, very near there. That was the, it was one of the larger ones that was left. There were two or three more down along Marine Way. There were several of them scattered around downtown. After the water receded completely, there was nothing left, not a stick in the boat harbor, no pilings, no docks, no nothing.
About downtown, was there anything left of downtown?
not much. There was a lot of damage. Most of the buildings within a block or a block and a half, in some places two or three blocks from the water, from the boat harbor, were destroyed. And then also some of the buildings that had been out at the Shahavka Cove area, in present Beachcomber location, were damaged or destroyed, including the old Beachcomber building itself, which was a log structure. It was very badly damaged and parts of it washed away. All the low-lying areas, but especially downtown. Another area that was very hard hit was Kelson Bay, where several people were killed in the first tsunami when they were trying to go along the old stretch of road, which in those days went right along the beach. They were progressing slowly back from the other side in Chiniac and Pisagchak area, trying to get back to town after the earthquake. And there were logs deposited on the road by the first high rise of the water. It was so low to the beach. And so they were going along slowly and then stopping here and there and getting out, pushing a log out of the way so the cars could proceed again. And they were midway along there, and the first tsunami hit. And
the first or the second?
The first tsunami.
Oh, okay.
First real wave. Because of the shape of the bay there, the tsunami was funneled and was very deep and violent, and it carried all those people and their cars up into the valley, and seven people were killed out there.
Oh, man.
I believe 19 were killed in town, most of them down in the boat harbor. Between the time of the first most severe earthquake and the first tsunami, when they were trying to get their boats out of the harbor.
So they really didn't have time to get out and get the boats out, huh?
They realized that if they could get their boats out of the boat harbor and out into the open water, they would stand a good chance of saving their boats. And many of them did, but many of them did not, and they were trying to do it when the first tsunami hit, and they were lost.
So pretty much everyone in town, though, knew once the earthquake hit to get up to high ground. I mean, it could have been.
Yes. We didn't know that there would be a tsunami, but when an earthquake that violent happens, your first instinct is to get up away from the ocean, and people did. They were running up the mountainside. Some of them drove up the road toward Pillar Mountain. It's a good thing, too, that we had about 33 minutes between the first earthquake and the first tsunami, a grace period that saved many lives during that period. Although the power was out and everything, the police, the troopers, the shore patrol from the base, all were able to work through the downtown area trying to clear the people out, and they did. Almost everybody got out of the downtown district before the first tsunami hit. The timing was good, too. It was just after the business day, so most of the stores had closed or were just closing. And the restaurants were not yet
busy,
or the clubs were not too busy with the evening trade. And they were able to clear all the people out of the downtown district, except, like I say, the people that were trying to get their boats out of the boat harbor, if you like that.
This was before the current tsunami system warning was in effect then? Did that system get set up because of the tsunami?
Yes.
As a direct effect? Okay, how about like the next day, a couple days? Did you have telephone service right away again, or did you?
Oh, no. The power was knocked out by the earthquake in the telephone service. So when the tsunami hit, we were already without power for a half hour or so. And then in certain parts of town, power was restored the next day or 2 days later, and some of it the next day. In our particular area up there on the side of the hill, we were about the last to have power restored, and that was 5 days. But we were lucky because it happened that the house we lived in, the heating system depended on an oil-fired furnace, but the fuel was stored in a tank above the house on the hillside, and the furnace was gravity-fed. And so after we cleaned out the lines and so forth, we were able to have some heat in the, not in the furnace, but in the old kitchen range. Because it was not dependent on an electric fuel pump or anything. As it turned out, that was the only place up there of all the hills, homes on the hillside, that had heat for the next 5 days.
Wow. Do you have a lot of company?
We had some. The neighbor ladies would bring their pots and pans over in the evening to cook their dinner and warm things up. The night of the earthquake, we had some people in the house who come up the mountain to get away from the water, and we invited them in, as our neighbors did too. We had a house full of unexpected guests through the night. Everybody very worried and trying to see what was going on.
What about like the access to food and water?
Well, there really wasn't any access to food and water for most of the town. People seemed to survive through what they happened to have in their cupboards and storerooms and so forth, and with sharing and so forth. And in our case, there was a little spring on the hillside not far away, and we were able to have fresh, good water through it all. But the city water system was out of service too up in that area for a long time. But we didn't suffer because we could go over to this little spring and get water for use. We were without telephone service for a long, long time afterward up in that area. Most of the telephone service in the town was restored after a few days, but not up there.
So you were able to call relatives in the States after a few days?
Yes. The White Alice system was knocked out of service, but only temporarily. The men that were on duty at the time were able to restore transmitters to service, and after about a half hour or 40 minutes or something like that, maybe even less. But it didn't help because the stations at Homer, at Soldotna, and at Anchorage were all knocked out of service for some time. So
could you communicate to anywhere else? I mean, did it get...
No, well, we were we were able, after a day or so, we were able to bypass Anchorage and talk to other stations in the system, stations that were not affected by the earthquake or tsunamis. As it happened, the day after the earthquake, we were able to get messages through to the White Owl station in Nome. And in Nome, there was at least one ham radio operator who was trying to collect messages from South Central Alaska, the areas that were hard hit, for forwarding to some of his contacts stateside. And I was able to forward a message to a cousin of mine in California, letting him know that we were okay and safe, and would he notify other relatives in Seattle and in Iowa and different areas, which they did. As it happened, that was the first communication that we were able to make with our relatives. Even for those in Anchorage, we didn't have any contact with them for several days.
So you were, but the town was pretty much shut down for, what, a matter of weeks, or as far as communications and food and...
Yeah, some communications were restored after a few days through the White Owl system. In the meantime, marine radio was about the only communication for a while, relaying messages through marine radios from the boats, to and from the boats, and the mainland. Some information was transmitted in that way during the interim. After the White Owl system was restored, of course, in Anchorage and the peninsula, more or less normal communications were available again, but downtown Kodiak was a mess. For a few days, we couldn't drive through the town from the area where we live, in the present location of the KI. It was blocked off there, and we were not able to drive through. But on the other side of the downtown district, you could. So by walking along the mountainside for a ways and then down into the Aleutian Homes area, I was able to get to and from the where we left vehicles, and then drive from there up to Pillar Mountain to get to and from work. But the downtown district was a mess. They immediately got bulldozers out and started clearing a path through the debris and the rubble so that emergency equipment could get through. And later, they did open up a road or two so that we could drive through the downtown district. Even then, there was one area where during the high tides for several days a month, high tides would prevent you driving through. That was right near the present location of Kraft's store, the downtown store. During high tides, the water would come up and cut the road, so you couldn't get through town. And that would continue for several months, a couple of days each month during the highest tides. And it was about 2 or 3 years before the downtown was rebuilt more or less in its present fashion, the mall area and so forth. After the earthquake, we weren't sure in Kodiak whether it was a local affair. We thought, we had no idea that it was extensive as it was at the time. We soon found out, however, that it was very extensive and very violent, and that the epicenter was up in Prince William Sound near Valdez. And and that Valdez itself was virtually destroyed. Other coastal communities, Seward was badly, badly hit, and certain other areas. The earthquake itself did an awful lot of damage in Anchorage and in other areas, and the earthquake itself was felt as far west as King Salmon and as far east as Glacier Bay, and north and south. Of course, it was very violent in Kodiak, and was felt up north of Anchorage, up north of Palmer, up in Hatch Pass area, and those little towns along the present Parks Highway, which didn't exist then. So it was a huge area that was affected by the earthquake, and some of it very violently. As I say, it was some time before we knew that, and found out how widespread the damages were and the effect of the quake, and in some places tsunamis, as in Kodiak. The White Alice system, when it was restored to service completely, of course resumed its function of furnishing the communications throughout the state. As I said before, it was designed primarily to handle military communications. That's why it was designed and built. It was owned by the Air Force, but it was operated and maintained by civilian entities through an M&O contract, which was reviewed every year and renewed every 3 years. ITT had the M&O contracts most of the time under license to one of their subsidiaries or another. RCA held the contracts for 9 years, I believe it was, out of the 20-some years that the system was in operation. It handled, of course, voice communication, depending on the terminal equipment applied to individual circuits or groups of circuits. It handled voice communications, like long-distance telephone trunks, quite a lot of teletype, some facsimile, some crypto circuits for military encoded equipment and information and so forth. It was even capable of use for television transmission, although it wasn't widely used in that capacity in Alaska. One other system that was based on the design for the White Alice system did use exclusively for television transmission between Miami, Florida, and Havana, Cuba. That was, of course, before Castro's day. But the system itself, what they called Tropospheric Scatter System, was developed specifically for the White Alice system, being designed for Alaska and for use for military communications, because they needed a higher degree of reliability. The White Alice system incorporated a number of different communications types. Here at Pillar Mountain, for instance, we had a number of small line-of-sight local microwave systems, one between Pillar Mountain and Chiniac Air Force Missile Tracking Station out there, another between Pillar Mountain and the Navy's Holiday Beach Receiver Site, another between Pillar Mountain and the FAA station on Woody Island, another between Pillar Mountain and Port Lyons for long-distance trunks. But the identifying characteristic of the White Alice network were the big parabolic antennas, called them screens. They're actually big parabolically curved squares, 60 feet on a side, very noticeable in the landscape where
they're still stationed,
and they're still there. They were part of the tropospheric scatter system, which was the main communication link between stations. It was found that in a certain frequency range, the energy that was transmitted, including the information and individual circuits and so forth, would be reflected by the lower level of the ionosphere, which is called the troposphere, and a certain very small percentage of the transmitted energy could be picked up and received by very sensitive receivers at the next station down the line, then retransmitted to the next one and so on, until eventually the military information wound up where it belonged, in Washington, D.C., or Colorado Springs, or San Antonio, wherever. Hmm. And of course, civilian communications go all over the world in the form of long-distance trunks and so forth. That's where it got its name, the tropospheric scatter, and that was a characteristic of the system as it was designed, especially for Air Force use in the White Alice system. The name, by the way, there have been different versions of it, but apparently it was named for the wife of one of the ITT executives. I don't know who Alice might be, never did find out.
Why she was called White Alice?
And White apparently was attached as a developmental code name for it, because it was to be used in the Arctic or subarctic. And the developmental code name just stuck after the system was developed and in constructed and in use, and it was called White Alice throughout its history. It finally was closed down, and in 1978, having been rendered obsolete by the launching and use of communication satellites. At that time, shortly before and shortly after, all the communications from the White Alice system, most of them, were transferred to the satellite system, and the manned stations in the White Alice system were shut down.
So you've seen, that was one major change you've seen in Alaska, was the communications from White Alice to satellite. Could you name a few of the others?
Well, of course, although Kodiak wasn't involved directly, and I was never involved in it, was one of the big changes in Alaska was development of the pipeline. But I imagine there are lots of other people can provide a lot better, more accurate information than I can on that. It certainly did provide a lot of jobs in this country for some years, and the state is still enjoying the royalties from the oil that's developed at Prudhoe Bay and Kaktovik and that country up there, and shipped through the pipeline to Valdez and from there to the refinery stateside. Another big change was the increase in population, and that resulted partly from the pipeline days, partly from reconstruction after the earthquake, a number of different factors. Recessions, economic conditions, and so forth in different parts of the country sometimes prompted people to back up and come to Alaska, or just the sense of adventure and curiosity. And As always, as it still happens, a lot of people come up for a visit out of curiosity or interest, and then they wind up staying here.
Sound familiar?
Yes.
Well, when you arrived here in 1954, did you still think you'd be up here in 1991?
No, I certainly didn't. While I was working at Bethel, I met a public health nurse who was stationed at the Native Service Hospital out there. She was Gretchen from University of Washington, a new graduate from nursing school at the University of Washington. Got her first job with the Alaska Native Health Service and lived at the Bethel Hospital facilities. But her work assignment was in a number of very small, at that time very primitive villages on the lower Yukon, not far away. And she would travel to and from Bethel to the Yukon villages in bush plain, and then between those villages, if they were nearby, by skiff in summer or dog teams in winter. Anyway, to make a long story short, I met her, and before her contract was up 2 years later, we had decided to get married, and we were married in Seattle in September of 1959, just before we came back, before we came to Kodiak.
And here you stayed.
Yes, here we are.
Well, thanks, Dad.